Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Cuppins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And our special guest today is James Westerman, who we could interview about I think, 100 topics. But we are going to begin with his new book, which is The Temple of Solomon, From Ancient Israel to Secret Societies, a book which is beautiful. The cover is beautiful, but also the layout, the way this book has been presented, is extremely beautiful, and that is rare these days. So, James, welcome to the show, and first of all, congratulations to a very beautiful book.
Well, thanks so much, Philip and Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
It's our pleasure to have you. So, the Temple of Solomon is probably something which everybody knows something about, but few people know, I think, a lot about. And yet, it is venerated by all religions. Well, not all, but the major ones. It is something which crops up so many times. We think of, you know, the Knights Templar. We think of Jesus, obviously, going into the temple and doing things there. Obviously, Moses, the Ark of the Covenant. But in the Temple of Solomon, you actually go back even further and say that this might be the Garden of Eden.
Well, indeed. The idea of the temple is that human and divine are in communion. And the first place where that really happens is in the Garden of Eden. You know, God, Adam, Eve are all kind of comfortably together. They're talking, they're walking, there's no need for work, no need for, gathering food, no need for even clothing, you know. They're at one in a sort of bliss, natural bliss with each other. Well, the Temple of Solomon wasn't quite like that, but it was also a place where God directly communicated to the high priest, at least, of the Jewish people in a sacred location and without the need of any intercessors. So it was a pretty, ecstatic form of communion in the Holy of Holies, you know, where God hovered above the Ark of the Covenant, in which were the two tablets of the law with the Ten Commandments directly inscribed by the hand of God.
If I remember correctly, this contact with the divine wasn't a daily occurrence. It was quite rare that the high priest established this contact. Is that correct?
Well, that's absolutely true. And that was another thing that distinguished it from the garden and also from the situation that Moses had, because Moses was able to talk to God pretty much at will, whether it was his will or God's will, but they had a pretty open communication. By the time Moses was succeeded by his brother as high priest, his brother Aaron, the high priest was only able to go into the temple, into the Holy of Holies, one day a year on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. So the rest of the time, the room of the Holy of Holies itself in the Temple of Solomon or in the tabernacle would remain essentially empty, except for this magnificent ark and the tablets of the law inside the ark.
So we have this magnificent building in the center of Jerusalem. It was made entirely out of gold, or at least clad with gold. What other kind of like physical descriptions do we know of?
Well, we know that it was, a little bit smaller than we actually might imagine it. I think it was like 60 by 90 feet or something. And it was, it had an antechamber to it, a nave, in which the priests could burn incense and bring in, the sacrifices. that were burned on the altar. Outside the temple was an altar of burning fire, where meat and birds and would be sacrificed. Incense would be burned in the temple, and sometimes the blood or ashes of the sacrificial animals would be carried into the temple and used to either coat the altar of incense or any of the other things that were inside. Sometimes blood would actually be sprinkled on the Ark of the Covenant itself, at least on the one day a year, on the Day of Atonement.
James, one of the things that you say in one of the pieces that I was reading, and I want to stop for a minute and say what I love about your work, the writing that I have read, there's so much passion in it. Not only is it beautiful and really, really full of great information, but you do write with an absolute passion for your subject matter, and it makes it, you know, so much fun to get to the information, and I wanted to say that. Now, you talk about how the Temple of Solomon remains as important today as the day it was completed in 960 BC. And this is something that I'm fascinated with, because we look at all these different time frames that have spanned over the last 3,000 years and how it was important. And I think I'd like to start from the beginning, which is sort of the foundation myth of Freemasonry, which goes back to the Grand Master Mason, Hiram Abiff. And I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about what you think he was, who you think he was, and how he figures into the myth as it has lived for the last 3,000 years.
Well, Hiram is an interesting character, and I appreciate what you say about the passion that I bring to it, because I think that, you know, I'm totally entranced with the whole subject of God and myth and religion. It just, you know, it's such a wonderfully intriguing part of human life, really the highest part, you know. Hiram was a workman skilled in brass and gold, and he could work with stone and wood, and he was a Sidonian. He lived in Lebanon. He was the subject of King Hiram of Tyre. And Hiram of Tyre was the friend of David, who was Solomon's father, David being, you know, of course, the biblical hero who slayed Goliath. And when Solomon mounted his father's throne, he wrote to Hiram and said, you know, I would like to build a temple to the Lord, and can you help? Because you guys are much better stone workers and have much better wood than we do here in Israel. So we'd like to make an arrangement. We'll trade you food for supplies and skilled workmen. And Hiram Abiff was the head workman, the head artisan of the Lebanese. He may actually have been Jewish. He's described as the son of, you know, what's quite potentially a Jewish mother, at least a widow son of the tribe of Naphtali, which is of course one of the Hebrew tribes. And you know, his father is called a man of Tyre, but he could well have been a man living there as well as a non-Jewish guy. We just don't know. But because of Hiram's mother being Jewish and, you know, matrilineal descent, Hiram may well have been Jewish. But in any case, he was living in Lebanon and he was sent to Solomon. And the idea was that he was an extremely not only skilled person, but that he and Solomon and King Hiram of Tyre had a very cordial relationship. And in fact, that they were the three Masonic officers of the day, and that the Temple of Solomon was the magnificent Freemasonic edifice that they built in conjunction to sanctify the glory and to celebrate the glory of God. And, it's the temple is the central point of the Freemasonic initiation. Symbolically, each Mason enters the temple during his initiation and is introduced to signs and symbols and tools that were all used to construct this temple to the Lord.
When we're talking about Freemasonry, we're obviously tackling very much a symbolic layer. And the building of the Temple of Solomon always has had very strong components and links to sacred design, to certain measurements. Is this something which has always been the case, or is that something which happened at one of the rebuildings of the temple, or is it actually something which was only added later once, basically all the temple was destroyed and we are in Freemasonic periods?
Well, you know, to my mind, it's a little, I don't quite have, you know, an understanding of the sacred measurements. In other words, if the temple measured 90 feet long by 30 feet wide and 45 feet high, those are the actual measurements of the temple. I don't know what particular significance the measurements have. That's not something I've studied in depth, but I do know that there are a couple of things that strike me. Number one is that it was oriented toward the rising sun, so that it was which is indicative of a solar temple, and of course, you know, the sun is the central symbolic archetype of all religion. So the fact that the Jews had a solar-oriented worship to me is just absolutely intriguing. The other thing that's interesting is that, you know, as you mentioned earlier, the entire interior was coated or plated with gold, so that that again gives a solar significance to it. Not only is it the most valuable of metals, but it is the metal of the sun. Of course, when you actually look where the temple was built, it was built on the threshing fields of Aruna, which is the Mount Moriah, which is presumably, by legend, it's where Abraham was about to sacrifice Isaac, the mountain that he went to when God tested him in his faith. It's also, by some, believed to have been the actual site of the Garden of Eden, where Adam and Eve are said to be buried beneath, the Mount Moriah. And there's a big rock there, in the center of this large rise. And that stone is called the foundation stone of the world, Evan Shatia, and it is believed to be the first physical manifestation of material being on Earth, like the point from which the entire Earth grew. And I write in the book, you know, just like a kind of vision that I was feeling of seeing this point of light, you know, kind of emerge from, let's say, the eye of God, or just some beautiful spark coming out into the universe and sort of hitting, a place of rest, and then forming itself into this microscopic stone that kind of just grew as a material object until it expanded to become the rock, and from there, in fact, the world. So it's pretty intense. The other thing I would say about the concept of sacred architecture that makes the temple clearly, a real example of sacred architecture is that all of the plans and all of the measurements were communicated directly to King David by God, whether it was in dreams or images, meditations, we don't know. But David assembled a complete set of plans that he passed on to Solomon. So the, you know, what I find interesting about that is not, again, so much the geometrical measurements, which I really don't frankly understand, but the fact that it was built on God's plan. And that's what makes it interesting. Just, you know, as a little aside, there are two different sets of measurements given in the Book of Chronicles and the Book of Kings, and they both say that the length and the width are 90 by 30, but in Chronicles, the height of the temple is given as 180 feet. And I mention in my book that that is the height at which the U.S. Capitol dome is built in direct, you know, relation to the measurements from the Bible. So there's just so many wonderful little mysteries going on here. And if I understood mathematics better, perhaps I would be able to speak even more about the measurements themselves.
And we'll get back to Washington in a little while. But staying for a moment, pretty much in prehistoric times, this tradition that this was the foundation stone of the earth, really, is that something which the Jews brought with them as they came out of exile of Egypt? Or is that something which was also native to that region? And how far back in time can we go to find the importance of this location?
Well, I don't really know the answer to that. The first time that the Bible mentions it is when Abraham is commanded to sacrifice Isaac, and he's told to go to the mountain of Moriah, and that's the name of the central place in Jerusalem where the temple stood. Now, it said that he was several days journey to the mountain of Moriah. So, based on where he was, which was South Israel at the time that he was given this command, it would make sense that he and Isaac would have, you know, wandered for a couple of days with their servants to go up to Jerusalem to the mountain of Moriah. So it would really be the case in the earliest book of the Bible. Abraham is said to have lived at least some 2000 BC, or, you know, what would essentially be 4000 years ago.
One of the things that you talk about is Jesus teaching at the temple. And I had a quote from you that I loved. What part of the relationship between human and divine did they not understand? Which is one of the things that you said here. But what I wanted to ask you specifically, if you could talk to this to my listeners. We talk a lot about the divine feminine on this show, which is my particular passion and what I write about, bringing women back into the spiritual equation. And one of the things that you say about Jesus at the temple is that he scandalized the ideologues by bringing her back, bringing the teachings back to women, helping them to find the lost essence of the Shekinah. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, sure. You know, the whole story of Jesus is really filled with a lot of women. And, you know, the funny part is that so is the Old Testament in particular. I mean, every one of the patriarchs had a wife, and between Leah and Rachel and Sarah, they were all really important and you know, constant topic in the Old Testament. But by the time the teachings of Jesus, by the time of the appearance of Jesus, there had been a degeneration in the understanding of Judaism among the Jews. I mean, they had really lost a huge part of their truth. And it was, you know, the mission of Jesus to reclaim it. And so, you know, we start out with the whole conversation about his mother. You know, she was such a significant person in his story, you know, having been touched by the Holy Spirit to begin with, and, you know, ever present as the Madonna. And indeed, he had female disciples, which was really a problem for a lot of people. It was one of the things that got him killed. He was, you know, freely associating with sinners, but he was also, you know, he had forgiven a woman caught in adultery in the temple, and, you know, very kindly, but, you know, but somewhat sternly told her not to sin any further. It's not that he approved of what she did, but he had compassion. And he surrounded himself with, you know, the various Marys of the Bible are just extraordinary in the sense that he treated them with such a high degree of respect. They were far from servants. They were really his companions, and, you know, they dressed his body after he died. He was anointed at the Last Supper by Mary. You know, Martha was basically complaining about Mary and said to him, "Would you please ask her to help serve the meal and clean the house and you know, be a proper functionary in the women's role?" And Jesus said, "You know, no, Martha. You know, you're really mistaking. Mary is really doing the right thing by paying attention to my teachings, because I'm only here for a short time, and it's what she is looking for is the truth. That's far more important than housework." And it was a novel concept, because, as I say, the Jews had degenerated. Don't forget, by the time Jesus came along, the Temple of Solomon had been destroyed almost 600 years before. So that was the first huge mistake that the Jews made. I mean, they not only did they lose the temple itself, but the Ark and the two tablets of the law, on which were the Ten Commandments, were also lost. So that, you know, there was a 70-year hiatus in the temple's existence. It was destroyed, let's say, 585 BC, and then in 515, the second temple was rebuilt. That's the one that Jesus taught at. So there was a temple on the premises, you know, on Mount Moriah for 1,000 years. But for half that time, there was literally no ark in the Holy of Holies. The Holy of Holies in the second temple was empty. It's quite clear that the Jews had lost a huge amount of their chosen status, let's say, and a huge amount of the truth that they had been given, and which they communicated to so many other cultures. Again, you know, Jesus was what came to reform, you know, the Jewish religion, and had they accepted him, he would have been a real powerhouse among them. As it was, they kind of rejected him, and he was forced, or at least his disciples were forced, to go out and teach in his name, you know, to many other nations. He was a reformer. He also spoke about healing. One of the most interesting parts about him that appealed to me was when he was criticized for healing on the Sabbath, you know, and he said to the people, "What are you talking about? It's like, you know, God is the one. We honor God on the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made, you know, to be the celebration of God's bounty and as the means of showing God our respect and a means for resting and kind of mimicking his behavior in the creation of the world. It's a day to honor God. What better way could I possibly honor God than to help heal his creations? And, you know, the more rigid Jews at that point looked at him like he was a sinner. It was really an interesting message that Jesus brought. And I was raised Jewish, so I try to, you know, pay my respects to him because I understand that, you know, in my book, I make clear that the Bible is one book. It's composed of the Old and New Testament. I don't think the Old Testament by itself is enough. And certainly the New Testament is simply, you know, is clearly based on the Old Testament. So it's sort of like part one and two of a single book. Really, really an important concept. We have one Bible in Judeo-Christian civilization.
And to a large extent, there is kind of like a book one or a period one, if you want, whereby we have the likes of Moses, Jesus, Muhammad coming to the temple and really the temple being linked with these great spiritual and religious reformers. And then there is another period of the temple, which definitely today I would mark as symbolic and or speculation. For a fact, the Knights Templar were obviously named after them. They were based there. And you've written a book about them, and I want to go into that right now. But then we also already touched upon Masonry. And both the Knights Templar and Masonry today definitely have this allure from, you know, the Da Vinci Code to everything else, the Raymond Curie books. They have this larger-than-life status. And basically, what is your opinion as a published author on the subject about what I would say the real Knights Templars are?
The real Knights Templars, I mean, it's hardly my opinion as an author that really counts here because, you know, there's a factual reality. In other words, the real Knights Templars were founded, let's say, in 1118, and they were destroyed in let's say 1314 or something. So there was a basically 200-year period when they functioned, and that was it. You know, they were disbanded by the church. End of story. The really interesting part to me about their reliance on the temple is that they were actually mistaken in their belief that they were in Solomon's temple. When they got to the Holy Land, you know, they came upon the Temple Mount, and standing on the Temple Mount were these two awesome buildings, you know, one being the Dome of the Rock, which is still there now, and the other being the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which at the time was much larger even than it is today. It's a beautiful building today, but it was even more expansive back then. And the king of Jerusalem had taken the Al-Aqsa Mosque as his home, because the Dome of the Rock itself is sort of sitting on top of this stone, the foundation stone of the world, and it kind of sticks up from the floor, so you couldn't really have a big place there. You know, you couldn't have a palace there or a capital building. That was reserved for the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that's where the Knights Templars were given lodging. But they thought that they were inside the real Temple of Solomon that they had all read about in the Bible. So it was actually a mistake. I mean, not really when you think about it, because it was, you know, it was clearly the same place, you know, the same location. But they saw themselves as the new Jews. They really saw themselves as the chosen people, the warriors of God. They saw themselves as redeeming the honor of the Holy Land, which was not only the scene of the of all of the story of the Bible, but the homeland of Jesus, and the sort of chosen place of the chosen people by the chosen God. And they saw themselves as very much that. They called themselves the New Maccabees. They were very involved in the whole idea of the warrior ethos that King David incarnated when he slew Goliath. He did so in the name of freedom, in the name of truth, in the name of God's will. And that's how the Templars conducted their battles. So, in essence, they were absolute devotees of the Temple of Solomon. And, it's said that when the order was destroyed in France, that the other Templars in Europe, particularly England, had, plenty of advance warning, like 6 months before the English king came after them. And they are said to have fled to Scotland, where they helped Robert the Bruce in his efforts against the English and in gaining independence. And that, curiously enough, turns out to appear to be at least the home of Freemasonry. So we look at the activities of the Knights Templars. If you go to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and it's pictured in my book, you can see the Crusader architecture. It's got the vaulted entranceways that were clearly done during the Crusades. And what people say is that there was so much castle construction going on in the Holy Land throughout the 200 years of warfare that the Templars were a part of during the Crusades, that they passed these secrets on to Europe when they returned, and that there was, the secrets of building, the secrets of the vaulted arch, the secrets of temple construction. These were all the legacy of the Knights Templar. And, I have none of us has any way of knowing whether that's true, but there's a logic to it. There were several castles that were, had been attacked by these Muslim engineers who had figured out ways to erode their foundation and really take them down from underground. So, the Templars had worked really hard. Castle Pilgrim in Acre is their finest example, where they worked to build an impregnable fortress that could not be taken down by the enemy. And in fact, it still stands today. So there was a great deal of architecture going on among the Templars and a great deal of identification with the Temple of Solomon, even if slightly mistaken, which only makes it more fun.
And so many people have been trying to bring the Ark of the Covenant in. Indiana Jones clearly goes in search of it. To some extent, the Templars are said to have been looking for it. But really, you hinted at it earlier on. We know that the Ark of the Covenant at some point disappears from the Temple of Solomon, but there's really very little historical information as to when precisely this is happening. So do you have opinions about it? And do you think, whether ever since it's been lost, it's really been lost? Or do you think we are still able to recover it at some point in time?
Well, Philip, that's a really interesting question. And what I mention in the book is that I really suffered with that question for, a long time of the writing. I wrote an afterword because I've never written that personally in a book before, but, you know, this thing really challenged me on a million different levels. You know, as I said, I was, you know, born and raised Jewish. I have a great deal of respect for, you know, my family heritage and all the rest of it. And, you know, I have tried and, you know, to understand the loss of the Ark. It seemed to me as a magician that, you know, you know, there are certain sacred objects that you put a lot of spiritual attention to, and that you build as a source of your own devotions. And then at the same time, you know, if they're old, something like miraculous, like the Ark itself, that was really well, at least the plan of the Ark was communicated to Hiram and the architects by God. So they were told exactly what size it would be and exactly what it would be made of and exactly how to construct it. And then, you know, you had these two tablets of stone that were, you know, literally written with God's finger, according to the Bible. And so that's something, you know, that as a magician, no matter what I could do, I've never had anything, you know, that powerful in my hands. One way to understand the Jews would be to say something like, well, I mean, they're the ones that had, you know, the tablets carved by the hand of God, and they had this wonderful Ark and, you know, all this Indiana Jones energy running around the whole scene. I mean, they possessed the single most powerful physical object, you know, in the world, in history. And that's pretty profound. But then they lost it. And they lost it through their own misbehavior. Not that God took it away from them because they were being, you know, these wonderful people and it was their time to pass it on and share it with others. God took it away from them because they had screwed up and not done what he had told them to do, you know, and they had fallen short of the glory of the Lord, which is something, you know, we all do. And so it was a pretty intense and painful experience for them. And it was a pretty intense and painful experience for me in trying to understand what the heck all this meant. Now, I was reading in the Apocrypha, and there's this very, which is books from the Bible that are not part of the actual official canon itself. And there is this wonderful story in there that the prophet Jeremiah had actually been warned by God of the approach of the Babylonians against the first temple and the fact that the temple was going to be destroyed because of the sins of the Jews. And he basically took the Ark and the tablets and carried them away. And then it says that he buried them on Mount Nebo, which is the mountain that Moses is buried on, or at least where Moses had died. And perhaps, you know, it could easily have been Mount Sinai. I mean, it could have been any mountain, but, you know, the idea was that it was believed to be at least the mountain where Moses died. And what the story says is that he buried it, and then his disciples had tried to make a map as to where it was, and he said to them, don't make any maps, because this is a secret, and it's hidden, and when the right time comes, God will reveal the location of the Ark and the Ten Commandments. And, you know, we still wait for that. So, you know, of course, you well know that some people claim it's in Ethiopia other people claim it's sitting in a warehouse in Hollywood somewhere with the Indiana Jones movies. You know, it's who knows where it is. But, you know, I came to an understanding, which I discuss in the book, you know, I guess at some personal length, which was pretty amazing for me to do. But, you know, I realized for myself, at least, that the Ark of the Covenant is our bodies, you know, and that the law of God is written in our hearts the same way that he wrote those laws on the two tablets of stone, and that in that sense the law is eternal, because those truths, the truth of the interaction between human and divine, will always be, you know, a fact of life, you know, God willing. And you know, we are really blessed individuals. We are a blessed race, and the human race. And if we can learn to make ourselves fit receptacles of the divine word, well, then maybe one day the Ark and the tablets will reappear, and we'll be able to celebrate their coming back to us, or maybe they won't. But I no longer worried about it, because I realized that they existed in my heart. I have a compass, and every one of us has a compass within us that tells us when we are deviating from the path of the Lord, and when we're following the divine inspiration that is our birthright. And that's what's really important about the Ark.
James, I have to tell you, I've been doing this show now for a little over 2 years, and I think that is my all-time favorite answer to any question we have ever asked. That was gorgeous. It was absolutely amazing. This, you know, this idea of, you know, the Ark of the Covenant is our bodies. It takes me to such an amazing place. And just now, as you were saying, you know, maybe the Ark will be recovered and maybe not. You know, it kind of takes me to that place of maybe it's not supposed to be, because we're no longer supposed to be looking outside of ourselves for this connection to the divine. And maybe that's the point. But I had to stop you there, because I was having a really profound experience with the answer that you were giving here about the Ark. And I just wanted to thank you for it, because it was really beautiful.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, you and Philip, I mean, I'm having like a pretty amazing interview here, because believe me, there's a synergy that happens between people when we talk, you know, and I feel it so strongly with both of you. So I cannot thank you enough.
Well, thank you kindly. And let's try to continue that, because, James, The Temple of Solomon isn't your first book. In fact, it's one of several. And one of the things you are very interested in and have written about is the occult in America. The first introduction to a two-part approach, which we're probably going to deal with for the rest of the show from now on, is a relatively recent book of yours called The Secrets of Masonic Washington, a guidebook to signs, symbols, and ceremonies at the origin of America's capital. Can you just briefly describe what that book is about and what that book is different from some of the other books out there on the same subject?
Well, what I say in The Secrets of Masonic Washington is that this country was founded on eternal principles, and that our founders were in many cases were Masons, and whether they were actually members of the Masonic Brotherhood or not, they were devotees of the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment basically said, you know, cast away all of the superstition, cast away the idea of the divine right of kings. Human beings have a reason to be on earth. We have a right to be on earth. We have a right to go as we will, to think thoughts of truth, to determine truth for ourselves, to not be held prisoner to ideas and beliefs that are little better than superstition and the forces of tyranny designed to keep us, you know, quote unquote, in our place. And what I do in the Secrets of Masonic Washington is I show examples of the architecture of the city in some really pretty color photographs. And I explain how they are symbolic of the values that the founders were trying to inculcate within us, courage, truth, the spirit of scientific inquiry, the spirit of good citizenship and service, the concept of law and equality under the law. The concept of a kind of impersonal approach to God in which he's not identified as either some being who is defined by a set of superstitions or in any way resembling the ruler in some sort of distorted cult of personality. But, you know, if we look at the Washington Monument, it's this absolutely impersonal, visionary appreciation for the interaction and the interplay between divine and human. It reaches up to the earth. It reaches up rather from the earth, you know, as this magnificent prayer to the heavens. And at the same time, it's considered a crystallized ray of sunlight that has descended from the heavens to the earth. So it completely symbolizes the interaction between human and divine. And, you know, when you read the American, you know, Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, you're going to find one of the most absolutely beautiful and inspiring religious texts on the face of the earth. I mean, he talks about rights coming from God. You know, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. And that, I believe, is what I try to hymn in my Secrets of Masonic Washington. You know, I also include this unbelievably beautiful prayer that George Washington gave. It was the proclamation for the first Thanksgiving. And just how important it was to those people. I mean, they're sort of like mischaracterized as deists and, you know, as if that's supposed to mean that they were half atheist or something. I mean, on the contrary, these were very religious, observant people who built a society based on a concept of morality and ethics and religion and self-control and self-discipline and a kind of form of acting within the parameters established by nature and nature's God in such a way that they could survive and be blessed. And you know, Washington's proclamation for the first Thanksgiving is just this beautiful testament to the religious roots of America, and something, you know, something we could do with listening to again today as we, you know, move further and further away from that concept and pretend that we're more free. If we can simply, you know, cast God out of the temple, we'll be more free. Well, hardly.
Well, this is, I think, the perfect segue to one of the things I really wanted to talk to you about in terms of Washington. You certainly have some very interesting information on your website. And by the way, we're going to post all this so that our listeners can get to your website and read some more, and also so that they can get to your books, JamesWassermanBooks.com. But we'll put all that up on the web so that they have that. But where does this take us? I mean, you talk about the beauty of this prayer and the beauty of the religious perspective and the idea of freedom and liberty that comes with it and the power of it. And as an American living in the 21st century, I just see that we're moving so far away from it in two directions, either too far into a fundamentalist religious perspective or too far into an atheistic perspective, because the pendulum continues to swing so hard. So where does this leave us as a nation? Because as an American, I have to say, I am currently in despair about the soul of our country and our political process. And I'd love to hear you talk about how we got off track and how we get back on track in this current political process that we're submerged in.
Well, let me start out by saying, Kathleen, that I'm in as much despair as you are. I think that what we do is we try to understand what the value of our founder's vision was, you know, and how it could be brought into modern times. You know, if you read the Constitution and you read the Bill of Rights and you read the Declaration of Independence, there is nothing wrong with those guys. You know that? They are, those three documents really do communicate human truth. The Declaration of Independence gives us the kind of philosophical plan. It doesn't talk about going to church 12 times on Sunday, but it talks about a recognition of God. It talks about rights, you know, that belong to us, not because the government gives them to us, but because we design a government that protects our natural rights, so that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights are kind of the working plan for keeping the Declaration of the spirit of the Declaration of Independence, you know, alive in a practical political construct. And I believe, you know, that there's, you know, I believe our goal needs to be to explore the timeless values that are shown, you know, if not in the behavior of Washington, D.C., hardly, but in the architecture, because those monuments and those ideals live forever. It's like ancient Greece. You know, we have never forgotten the value of democracy. It's like ancient Rome. We have never lost the concept of a republic. It's like ancient Israel. We've never lost the concept of a temple of the Lord. You know, each one of these things is an ideal that lives and lives forever. But in order to strengthen it and purify it and make it strong, we need to study it. And we're not doing that in our schools today. And we're electing people to political office who truly despise the Constitution and who are telling us increasingly the truth about how little regard they have for it. They complain about it. You know, they have an oath to uphold it. It is the law of the land. And if we insist on making it once again the law of the land, we can turn this back. You know, I hate to sound like a Ron Paul supporter, but the fact of the matter is I am a Ron Paul supporter. I'm supportive of anyone who is talking about the Constitution, who's embracing the Constitution. I believe that these values are our salvation as they were the last time. Remember, we were in a tyranny the last time. And what happened is we embraced a set of values as a nation to get out of that tyranny. And if you read the specific complaints about the English monarch in the Declaration of Independence, where Jefferson so carefully lists them one by one by one and says all the stuff that you know, was wrong, you'll find that almost every one of them is the modern state of modern America. You know, there's no respect for law here by the government, and there is no insistence for keeping the government in its place by the population. So we need to really seek after, you know, a national, I don't know, I hate to use words like redemption, but maybe recovery or something, a way of saying to ourselves, I have two kids, and, you know, I've really tried to explain to them how important American freedom really is. It's not that I'm some jingoistic American, far from it. I think the French or the Syrians or the Egyptians would love to have the kind of freedom that we do, you know, and I see no reason why they shouldn't once they've matured enough as a society to be able to be worthy of it. But you do not, America is not designed as a democracy. You know, I explain in one of my books that, you know, democracy is best explained by two wolves and a sheep voting on what to have for lunch. That's not the way it works. You know, we're a republic. In other words, we're a democratic republic.
The Temple of Solomon, Washington, today, both of these things today, when you look at the world of politics, they are, you know, they were designed to be order over chaos. They were there to bring this order. But really, Jerusalem is definitely somewhat short of a war zone, and Washington is a verbal war zone, and neither really are served with these grand ideas, this divine quest of like, you know, what we read in the Bible, these people going to worship and have direct communications with gods, the stories about you know, the divine rule, whether you want to do that in the Masonic tradition or the imagery of the founding fathers embedded within Washington. Is it just something that lives in our mind that this is, you know, really a war zone, or is it something new, or is it really always been like that? And are we just looking at it through rosy-colored glasses and saying that the past was better than the present?
No, I don't see it that way so much, Philip, as I see it as a beacon of hope for the future. And in that sense, I'm an eternal optimist. And I really hope and pray that the image that we hold in our minds, whether it's true or not, of what happened in the past, I pray that we can realize and build that vision for ourselves in the future, because that, I think, is the true hope of humanity and why we're here on Earth.
And that is a great way of ending our hour with you, Jim. Just a brief mention, your books are available from your website, jameswassermanbooks.com. The latest one is The Temple of Solomon, and we will put all of those links on our website. We haven't even touched topics like Aleister Crowley, so we will have to get you back on to talk about that, as well as a book you're working on right now, which is about occult people in the Center of the Fire, a memoir of the occult in America, 1966 to 1989. But for now, this is the end of the Spirit Revolution for this week. If you want to listen to this interview again, you can do so in a number of ways. There is Facebook.com/Spirit Revolution. Our own dedicated website, thespiritrevolution.com, where you can listen to the last 5 interviews. You can go to the BBS Radio Archives at bbsradio.com, where you can listen not just to our shows, but to dozens of other shows and all of their archive material. And finally, there is iTunes, where you can download more than 1.5 years of our shows completely for free. Kathleen and I will be back next week, but until then, from the both of us,
the truth against the world.